Hi folks, I'm Mark Fallows and this is the Impossible Network podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast player. And please leave a rating and a review because it helps more people find us. If you want to find out more of what we get up to or suggest who we interview next, follow us on Instagram at The Impossible Network or visit theimpossiblenetwork.com. Okay, let's get started. In part two, we explore how Emily met and formed a 17-year partnership with Bonnie Siegler, forming their New York design firm, Number 17, before we dive deep into her 20 seasons of driving the identity of Saturday Night Live. We also discuss her leadership experience at Pentagram and the challenges of combining that with motherhood. Finally, we discuss diversity, and of course, we get our quickfire questions and answers. I hope you enjoy the curiosity, humour, and design principles of Emily Oberman.
That experience with T-Bar must be very hard leaving M & Co. if they were so bound up with your life and the direction and your development as a designer and as a human being. What was it that made you then leave to go and set up your own studio called Number 17 with someone called Bonnie Siegler?
Couple of things. Bonnie and I had met before I started working at M & Company. We met at a job that we both worked at for a short period of time at a studio called Marcus Ratliff Incorporated. I opened the door. I worked there already. I opened the door when Bonnie walked in, and it was kind of one of those, "Hi, I'm Emily. Hi, I'm Bonnie. Want to hang out after work?" Like, it was just like that. And we always knew that we would wanted to have a design studio together, but we also knew that we needed to learn and experience and explore different things. And so that was always something sort of in the back of my mind while I was at M & Company. Not that I was ever anything but 150% committed to working at M & Company when I was at M & Company. I sweated and bled M & Company for 6 years, which is longer than anyone ever worked at M & Company. And a couple of things were happening. I'd been there for 6 years, which is a very long time, and it's a hard job. Very demanding. Tibor is a demanding guy. And at the same time, Tibor's interests were sort of changing. He had sort of fallen in love with Colors magazine. I worked on the very first issue with him. But he wanted to do more editorial. He wanted to do more content in a different way. And so his focus was less on sort of M & Company. Not M & Company, because of course that's his soul. But his focus was changing at the same time as I'd been there for about 6 years. So it just seemed like time. It was really hard. But the nice thing was that I continued to do a couple of projects with Tibor. Like at Number 17, we did a couple of projects with Tibor. So it sort of softened the separation a little bit. And it was the right time to change, to grow.
Did you manage to open the studio with a founding client?
We did.
You did.
And what was nice is that Bonnie had been working at VH1. For years. When she left, they hired us to do ad campaigns for them and to do branding work for them and to do some on-air work for them. So they came with us to Number 17. So we had VH1 and Viacom as a client from the beginning at Number 17.
So a little less to worry about as a founder.
A little bit. Plus, we worked out of Bonnie's apartment, so we had no overhead. One computer that we shared. And it was time. I still, when I talk about M & Company, I still say we, which makes me really happy. And I hope it makes Tibor happy, wherever in the universe he might be. It's still part of my DNA. And Myra, of course, has evolved even further. She was always a huge, huge, huge part of M & Company, the M of M & Company. Yeah. But what she became, not what she became, because she always was that, but what she continues to do is mind-blowing to me. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
I've heard you say that you didn't really have a business plan when you set up Number 17, but you did have a plan, which was pretty simple, which was to do good work for smart people and for products that you actually liked. I mean, that's the perfect combination, really, for anyone working in any creative field. But it's very hard to do. There's not that many smart people around. And you have worked with some extraordinary brands. How did it evolve?
I have no idea. I really don't.
Because I want to be, we've got our own small agency. We work with clients, and we tend to do the same. Mm-hmm. But we could do with a bit more scale on the size of some of the brands that you've worked on. So are there any lessons there that we can take from what how you approach this?
I mean, it's all well and good to say good work for smart people. Hopefully they're smart. Hopefully the work is good. The other thing is you could be a smart person and not a good person.
right. Yeah, that's fair enough.
So that's the other, that's the other piece that I'd like to add, that I try to add now, is good, smart work for good, smart people. I mean, that was something that, it was never a question between me and Bonnie at Number 17, that if there was a client that we didn't like or someone came to us for a product that we didn't believe in, we never just said yes. Mm-hmm. Our overhead was low enough that there was never a moment where we had to do work for a company we didn't believe in or couldn't stand by. I don't want to sound like everyone on earth has that luxury, because I know that that's not always true. We were lucky enough, and I think at Pentagram we also are lucky enough that we don't have to do work for people that we don't believe in, or brands that we don't believe in, or companies that we don't feel simpatico to. But the smart people is something that I feel like I've been pretty lucky in. I think often our clients are people who I respect for the way they think and the kind of presence that they bring to a project. It's not always the case.
But I suppose it's also the trust. You've got the, coming from the time you spent the 6 years at M&Co, it must have given some confidence in a lot of the clients to work with you, and with the work that Bonnie had done in the past as well, particularly working with amazing, like Lauren Michaels. I mean, this, you know, an icon in his own lifetime. I mean, to have worked with him over such a long period, he must have trusted in your judgment, which is incredible to have that privilege to work with someone like that.
I don't know how much he knows that he was trusting in my judgment specifically. Saturday Night Live is a very well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. We did the work for the titles for Saturday Night Live mostly through the film unit, for a long time through a man named Jim Signorelli, who is the guy who created all the parody commercials throughout the years. Like a genius. Crazy person. Genius. And so we worked with him. And so there, I think there were years where I don't think Lauren Michaels knew exactly who it was that was doing all this work for him.
But he liked what he saw.
But he liked it and he trusted. And he trusts, now he does. Now I don't know if he passed me in the hall, if he would be like, hey, Emily. But now he knows who he's working with. But he trusts his team a lot. That's the well-oiled machine part of Saturday Night Live, where we'll work this current iteration of the titles for Saturday Night Live. He saw a mood board and then a test that we made with Truffaut Films, because it was all meant to feel a little French New Wave. And then he didn't see the titles till the dress rehearsal on the day of the season premiere.
Wow.
So
that's leaving it late.
It's a tight. I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't liked them. They were good. I don't think that Mary Ellen Matthews, the photographer for SNL, she and I did the titles together with the film unit. We knew that they were pretty good, so I wasn't that worried. But again, as a worrier, mm-hmm. There's certainly something in the back of my mind saying, like, what do we do? What happens at 11:30 if he doesn't like these? But he did like them. But that's this sort of, and I love that. That's, again, that goes back to the sort of method acting and to the smell of the grease paint. Like, I love that right down to the wire. I don't love it with every project. I just say I have.
But you thrive on it.
I think I thrive on that sort of energy, but especially with Saturday Night Live, which I have loved for all 45 years of its existence. I remember where I was the first time I watched the show. Mm. I remember where I was when the show premiered. I was a kid, and I got to stay up and watch it. And it, like, you know, fireworks went off in my head. And I have carried that love for that show with me for 45 years. And so there's something, that energy that Saturday Night Live has is something that sort of, again, fills my soul with a kind of exuberance that I understand.
How many seasons have you worked on it now? Is it over 20?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
How do you remain so fresh, energized, and focused with... I mean, I know that there's a formula to Saturday Night Live, and it's like, say, it's a well-oiled machine. It's amazing that it's gone on for so many years. But there must be a point sometimes where you think, is it time for some new blood? Should someone else take it over? But if not, how
no.
do you... No! No? Not a chance. Get your hands off it.
That day may come.
Have there been times over the last 20 years when you've gone, oh, I'm struggling with this one?
Yeah. You know, because it is. It's the same brief every year.
Yeah.
It's New York City.
That's what I'm saying. To have the same brief year in, year out, and not feel, to remain that fresh and energized, is say something about your character and your uniqueness in terms of the designer.
Dog with a bone.
So let me just contextualize it for maybe listeners that haven't watched or aren't that familiar with Saturday Night Live, because not everyone is listening to the show in America. You do the design for the opening of the show and the closing credits for every season when it starts, and it's a new brief every year. Is that correct?
It's the same brief every
year. Same design brief every year.
The brief for the titles for Saturday Night Live is the same and has been the same since 1975 when it premiered. It's New York City at night, the most amazing party that you wish you were at with the cast members. The city is gorgeous. The people are having a great time. That's the brief. One of the things that we always say is that the show is funny, hopefully. The opening titles are not. Mm-hmm. The opening titles are this beautiful introduction into the world of New York at night. So we're never trying to be jokey with what we do. It's supposed to be fun and funny and have that element of sort of wit. I think all design should have an element of wit. And by wit, I don't mean humor. I just mean a shared experience, I guess. And so we shoot in and around the city. And then we also shoot the cast members in and around the city. And it's all done in the week or two before the season premiere. And we do the opening sequence about every 3 or 4 years. It gets redone. So it doesn't get redone every year. Mm-hmm. It gets redone sometimes when a big chunk of the cast changes, or when there's a specific anniversary. The last time we did it before this most recent one was at the 40th anniversary. So there was a special opening title sequence done to celebrate the 40th anniversary. Now we're in the 45th. I don't know when we'll do it again. This is the second year of this iteration. So it's not something you have to figure out every year. So you get to sort of think about it a little bit. And the idea is always to sort of reinvent what that experience is. Like for the 40th anniversary, because it was grand, we worked with Rhys Thomas, who is the director, and he got a helicopter, which we'd never done before. And the helicopter flew over the city. Usually it's very run and gun, mm-hmm. kind of down and dirty,
yes.
guys on the street. And this was to give the whole thing this idea of this grand celebration. So suddenly you're up above New York City at night and it's beautiful. And then you sort of come down for these moments with the cast members. And we tried to make the typography have a sort of quality of something that looked like maybe it was left in your VCR for 40 years, because it was 40 years of SNL. That was sort of the idea behind that. And then this year, we wanted to sort of celebrate the idea of French New Wave combined with New York New Wave. We wanted to bring black and white back into it and sort of a big kind of typography that we hadn't done before. And so you're sort of always trying to think of something that feels a little different from whatever the previous was. And the cast is delicate dance, not because they're difficult, but because most of them don't get back into the city till the week before. So you're shooting 20 cast members or 17 cast members the week before, and you start shooting at 8 o'clock at night, mm-hmm. and you shoot till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. I've been at shoots for cast members where they arrive for hair and makeup at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
One of the best New York experiences of my life was the shoot for Kate McKinnon in this current iteration of the mm-hmm. Open, which takes place in the Metropolitan Museum. We were in the museum at 2 o'clock in the morning, wandering around.
The Egyptian room?
We were in the Egyptian room, yeah. and just being in the museum at 2 o'clock in the morning was just such an incredible, like, I'm a born and bred New Yorker, but such a New York moment that most people don't get to get. I just.
It's extraordinary.
This is a good one.
Okay, you just answered why it keeps you fresh. I understand. Anything getting experiences like that would energize anyone.
There's also the other great thing about Saturday Night Live is, again, it feels really like that sort of like backstage. Like, you can be backstage while they're doing the show. If on the occasions that I go, you get to stand in the hall and literally someone will walk by with a llama, like, and it's like being on an old studio
also
lot.
Being a native New Yorker as well and designer, being part of the fabric, not just the fabric of American society, but fabric of New York society and culture, it must be amazing.
I love it. I love doing work for the city that I love. It's why I love, we just finished doing the identity for Hudson River Park. Uh-huh. All the signage went in this summer. It's beautiful and I'm proud of it. I spend a lot of time in Hudson River Park. Being able to brand something that's part of the city that I love, that is meant to sort of relate to Paula's High Line, which is the gold standard mm-hmm. of signage in the city, makes me really proud. It's also why I love being at Pentagram.
Yeah. Well, that takes us nicely to Pentagram. You moved here to be a partner. How have you managed to balance motherhood with the challenges of having a partner role at such an iconic firm?
Very poorly.
I'm sure it's Harry and Eli.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure Harry and Eli are very happy with Mum at the moment.
They love Pentagram. Mm-hmm. They love coming to Pentagram because when they come here, they bring comic books that they have drawn and written.
Uh-oh, and we see another couple of designers coming onto the scene pretty soon.
Reunion.
Yeah.
Hopefully. And they sell them here.
Nice one.
So
wow.
That is...
I thought you were going to say they love coming here because they get to do some work on the side and get some a nice sort of minimum wage.
Well, they get them. They design their comic books and they peddle them. They love being here. They love Paula. They love her work. They've spent a bunch of time with Paula. And so they're always really happy to be here when she's here. And they do love coming here. And they love being able to say, like, much to my own chagrin, like on Halloween, some kid will walk by in a Harley Quinn costume and Harry will say, like, my mom designed the DC logo. And I'm like, they don't want to know that. And it sort of takes any conversation you're having with a parent in a whole different direction. But they are happy and proud of being associated with Pentagram. They both are interested in design and logos and comic books and music. But it makes me feel, it's hard. Mm-hmm. I just, being a mother of twins, a full-time mother of twins, even though I'm not there during the day, I'm still a mother full-time, mm-hmm. and a full-time partner at Pentagram is not easy. Yeah, I always feel like I'm not quite giving either one of those things enough. Mm-hmm. That may not be the case, but that's how I feel.
And you married a designer, Paul, as well. So design's really been kept in the family.
Yeah. Yes. Paul and I, on our first date, had a giant fight. Not a giant fight. We had our, like, a serious, like, we don't see eye to eye on this about open outline typography.
I thought you were going to say some sort of font or serif.
Yeah, no. Whether you should be able to use typefaces as outline or not. I was pro.
And you went on a second date. That's good.
We did.
Yeah.
I think the banter was good enough.
You obviously won the argument.
Yeah, the banter was good enough that there was a second date. But yes, design is a very important part of what I love about Paul. Is he's one of the best designers I've ever met. We do very different kinds of work. And that's nice. I always show him what I'm working on. Or I try to always show him what I'm working on. Sometimes it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm like, hey. Could you look at this? I have to present it tomorrow. And he shows me what he's working on. And it's we're both workaholics. We're both passionate about what we do. So it's nice to have someone to talk about it with who I think always makes it better. Mm-hmm. And especially because we do such different kinds of work. Sometimes I wonder what it would be like to be married to someone who wasn't also a designer. Same thing as having parents who are designers. Yes. Like, sometimes I wonder what it would be like to not have had parents who were able to say, you went with Futura. I wouldn't have done that. So it's a, you know, it's a double-edged sword, but I love him.
Well,
what are you going to do?
We've got 15 minutes left, so I'm going to have to get to the quick-fire questions.
Sorry.
I did want to ask you about diversity and inclusion in the industry, but we'll have to maybe do that another time. I was also going to ask you about curiosity and creativity and how it's contributed to your success, but I don't think I need to add to that because you're clearly an incredibly curious and uniquely creative individual. So I think that's your answers have answered that. So quick-fire questions.
I just want to say, I'm also exhausted. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the other thing about the motherhood, the pressure, the job. I don't want it to sound like, I feel like sometimes it sounds like work is all joy and easy and you do it because you love it. I've gone to so many design lectures where people say, follow your passion, follow your heart. It's not that easy.
It's a craft.
It's not, yes, no. Exactly. It's not. Working on Saturday Night Live sounds like fun, but it's really hard. And it does mean that I'm not at home for many nights. It means I get home late. It means my kids get haircuts a month and a half after they should have. You know,
sure they're not worried about that.
No, they're not. But it is hard. And I think as a woman, it makes being a woman in a position of leadership in the design world, it makes it clear why it's so hard.
Yeah.
And I think we here at Pentagram, you know, when I joined Pentagram, Paula was the only woman partner. There have been other women partners, but when I joined, there was Paula. And now here in the New York office, there are 3 other women partners. So of the 9 partners in New York, 4 of us are women. But it is something that we are aware of and trying to sort of lead by example, I would say, in terms of that, if that matters. But my main point was, I know I sometimes make things sound like they're not as difficult as they have been, and that I have worked really frigging hard to be able to sit here with you and talk about work, life, how fun it is to be at the Metropolitan Museum at 2 o'clock in the morning. But it's because I work hard.
And I think that's really important to get across as well, because I think people from the outside looking in, particularly looking at someone that's achieved the success that you have, maybe comes to an assumption, she maybe worked hard early on, but it's now just living off the success. But I think people, I mean, I certainly find this. I think life's never got easier in terms of doing quality work, regardless of the stage of your career or the level you're at. It takes the same principles of dedication, sacrifice, hard work, persistence, grit, all these characteristics that lead you to sitting here. And I don't think it ever gets easier. And for people that think it does, they should maybe wake up.
I'm waiting for the moment that it gets easier. Like, there are days when I'm like, why is it still so hard? But
But it's good. It's the process, and yeah. That's what we love.
True. Okay, sorry.
The quick fire questions. What principles do you stand by?
I do stand by do good, smart work for good, smart people.
Yeah.
But that also is spend time being good and smart with good, smart people. And I also believe in, you know, being as kind as possible to the planet.
Mm-hmm. And getting your kids' haircuts once every 6 weeks.
Oh, God. Once every 6 months.
What hard choices have you had to make, but were tough at the time, but turned out to be the right decision in the end?
I think the ending number 17
that
was a really hard choice for both of us. Mm-hmm. We decided to do it independently. I think that we each wanted to try other things. And we thought about it for a long time. And I think that that was difficult for both of us because it was a beautiful thing. But in the end, I'm glad that it gave me the opportunity to come and sort of find this new chapter at Pentagram. And I know that Bonnie is happy. But that is the hardest professional thing.
Yeah. Where do you go to discover new ideas? Because you need a lot of them. You're busy, got demands.
I have two places. Mm-hmm. To sleep. Mm-hmm. I think that sort of time before falling asleep, while asleep, and shortly after waking up, there's kind of like moments of thought and clarity and panic. Mm-hmm. Like those middle of the night, waking up moments where perhaps a good idea comes. And then I want to say museums and galleries and books and magazines, all of which is true. And sometimes the easiest place to find all of that is online. So I use all of those tools, I guess. Mm-hmm. I use magazines, books, music, art, and the internet.
Good combination.
It's a cheat.
And a little bit of Monty Python thrown in from time to time.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You're right. Wait. I want to completely take back my answer. My answer is I go to content that I love. I go to humor. I go to song. I go to comedy. I do. It's true.
That makes complete sense. Who's made you reevaluate yourself?
Everybody. My father, when he was alive, was very good at finding the way to that sort of needled me, not in a bad way, but that made me think about what I was doing in an interesting way that's always snuck up on me. Mm-hmm. My father was very good at sort of being able to have me think about what I was doing and get me to question whether I was doing it the right way. He was incredibly supportive. So it wasn't like he ever made me think that I was wrong or bad, but he definitely was able to get me to think about how I behave, how I conduct myself, who I am. But I do also want to say that can come from anywhere. I try to, and I would like to think that kind of self-reevaluation can come from anywhere. Like can come from me thinking about how well I'm behaving with my team and what kind of signs I get from them makes me think about how I should pivot. Mm-hmm. I try. I don't know if I always succeed, but I certainly try.
Okay. The impossible question. What would your advice be to someone who's just about to graduate, go to study, and might have a dream, a grand ambition, but has been told that's impossible?
Is it? Is it impossible? That would be the question that I would ask.
Yeah.
My advice would be to try to make it possible, to work really hard. Again, it goes back to that sort of working really hard. I don't want to sound Pollyanna. I don't want to sound like, oh, if you try really hard, it'll happen. I don't know if it will. But if you don't try really hard, it definitely won't.
Yeah.
So the advice I would have is believe in yourself and try.
Yeah.
Try, 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 and work hard when trying.
No, it's great advice.
Doesn't everybody say that?
No, they don't. No, everyone's got a slightly different answer. So, yeah, we've had many. Maybe we should start to collate them all and publish them. Might be a nice blog post. I'm going to get through the last couple of questions. If I do have time, I would like to ask you about your perspective on failure. We added a few questions to this recently. What's one problem worth solving in the world today?
Climate change is the one.
Okay, we're agreed on that. It's definitely the it's definitely the number one.
Yeah. Changing who the president is also.
Well, those are bound up in...
They're completely... Yeah. They are wrapped up in each other, but yes, saving the planet.
I'm getting Bloomberg to run. Huh. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Like a Prayer by Madonna.
Nice one. And the best recent Netflix or Amazon series?
Oh.
Or any series, for that matter.
Well, Amazon, I have to go with Fleabag season 2. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Beyond great. Beyond great. If you have not...
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it. She's incredible.
She's unbelievable. She's a...
Yeah.
Okay, weekend viewing. Book would you like us to offer 3 listeners that submit the best comments in the comment section?
It's a book called Devil in the White City by Eric Larson.
Okay. Who should we interview next?
Mary Ellen Matthews, the SNL photographer.
Okay. All right. We might need you to make a little introduction for us. That's good. I'm going to come back to the question, what's your perspective on failure?
My perspective on failure is that me personally, I wish that I were less worried about it. I think you can learn a lot from failure, and if you have a certain degree of confidence, you can learn more from failure. If you have too much worry, you spend too much time fearing failure as opposed to embracing it or learning from it. And having that be the thing that helps you try again better. So for myself, I wish that I were not as fearful of it. Because I think good can come from
it. Does it ever stop? Does it ever get easier for you? I know I've heard you say that you wake up in the morning and you go to bed at night living with that sort of the fear because it's what drives you. But over time, when you've achieved the sort of the success and the position you're in now, surely it's a little less than it maybe it used to be?
Sure. I'm hoping that it is. I believe that it is. I would say that I am less worried about what other people think or what happens when something doesn't go perfectly, but it's still there. It still gnaws at me. It still eats at me in a way that I think that I would be a better designer, a better boss, a better mother, a better person, if I were able to sort of accept it and learn from it and move on. And so I think slowly the balance is shifting, but not perhaps as slowly as I would like.
Okay.
Not perhaps as quickly as I would like.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a nice place to end. I mean, I'd love to talk longer, but we have to wrap up because I know you've got to go. I'd just like to thank you and acknowledge you for your curiosity, which I think is certainly... We've interviewed some extraordinarily curious people, and I think your curiosity just comes across in your character. You exude it. Your love of story and belief in the power of ideas, and of course, for your weirdness. And the term you used, the way you described yourself as, what was it, weird?
Beautiful weirdo?
Beautiful weirdo, yeah. I absolutely love that. And I want to sort of adopt that and have a badge. Walk around now with beautiful weirdo.
That's a great idea.
I think it's wonderful.
And podcast. A new podcast.
Yeah, it could be. And really just for your nonconformity, because I think that's what's, I suppose, in a way, it's defined your career through design and kept you fresh. So thank you very much for your time. And just the final thing I was going to say, when I was doing the research for you, I absolutely love the typefaces that you came up with and the names for them. The fantastic Beast, the ones for Fantastic Beasts. Was it Crimes New Roman?
Crimes New Roman.
I love it.
I got to give that to Tim Cohan, one of the associates on my team. That was his name. My role in that was just saying yes.
Yeah, but all the same, I mean, to be have a legacy that has created the work that you've created, it's amazing. And the more people should know your name when they see this amazing design that and surrounds our life, and particularly living in New York. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank
it's
you.
It's been wonderful. And look forward to interviewing
Mary Ellen Matthews.
Mary Ellen Matthews. So
thanks. She's great.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Just go to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever podcast player you listen to subscribe and rate. And if you like the show, please give us a 5-star rating, as it helps more people discover us. If you want to learn more or have someone you'd like us to interview, just visit us at theimpossiblenetwork.com or DM us on Instagram at @theimpossiblenetwork. For now, be curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.